I'm on the phone with comedian Paula Poundstone, who will be appearing at the Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo this coming Saturday, presented by Otter Productions and Cal Poly Arts. Paula's double comedy CD from last year, North by Northwest, debuted at number one on Amazon and made Billboard's top 10 comedy CDs. And she has a new book coming out in May that we'll be talking about. Welcome, Paula.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. We get to hear you many weekends on the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
That is because I am the luckiest performer in the world. That show is so much fun to do. We sit in a chair and laugh. I don't know. We think of things that we think are funny and we say them. And we listen to the things that our coworkers say that are funny and we laugh. It's a gem and a treat.
How did you hook up with Peter Sagal and the Wait, Wait team?
In the most boring of ways, they called me and asked me. I'm sure they hate it when I say that. I had never heard of the show. And it was many years ago. They sent me an audio cassette of it, and I put it on the island in my kitchen, and it gathered, you know, dust for a while, which is I knew what would happen with that stupid island thing in the kitchen. When I looked at that house, I said to the real estate person, I go, can we get that thing out of the center of the kitchen? And she said, oh, no, that's your island. You're going to love your island. And we did vacation there many summers. But outside of that, it gathered dust. And so there that cassette tape sat until I had a nanny at the time who said he saw it. And he said, oh, I love that show. You have to do that show. So I did.
And you've been doing it for a while now.
Yeah, I think about 15 years. Yeah, a really long time.
Normally, as a stand-up comedian, you would be on the stage by yourself. What's it like to share the stage with several comedians on a panel like you do on Wait, Wait?
It's delightful, actually. You know, we break bread before we go on. It's nice to be with other people for a little while. One of the really fun things about the show is, well, first of all, it's a little bit like being a batter in a batting cage. You know, we get sort of lobbed topics. There's no script for the panelists, except for we know that it's the questions are going to be based on the week's news, but other than that. But, you know, you sort of get lobbed questions, and, you know, sometimes I swing and I miss, and sometimes I get a little piece of it. But the really fun part is that if one person thinks of something funny about the question that's asked or the topic at hand, nobody cares if everybody else piles on. So one person sort of, you know, has a premise and everybody else, you know, jumps in with jokes. Nobody really goes back and says, well, you know, that was mine or that was mine. Or I mean, that's sort of the fun part of it when there's just a whole free-for-all, you know.
So in addition to Wait, Wait, you make appearances all over the country. I was just looking at your tour. That is a lot of dates. How many do you do a year?
I do about 90, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is I just plain love the pat-down at the TSA. And what better way? You know, if I just hung out there, eventually they'd be suspicious. But if I appear to be on my way to work, I get away with it.
So who takes care of the pets while you're gone?
My nanny that took care of my children. For many years. They no longer require that kind of care, and therefore she just comes and takes care of the animals, and it seems to work out okay.
So you have two dogs and 14 cats, is that correct?
I do, because I'm an idiot. I'm trying now to make, like, I keep trying to make promotional offers using cats, you know. You know, the first people through the door get a cat. Just even here at my house, you know, the third person to ring the doorbell in a day gets a cat. I've done what I can, but I still have 14 cats.
So does that make you a cat lady?
Well, no, not really, and I'll tell you why. Because I do also have two German Shepherd mixed dogs. If I only had 14 cats, yes, I might well be a crazy cat lady. But if I have 14 cats and two German Shepherd mixed dogs, that makes me an animal lover. The dogs are beards, really.
So your kids are all grown up now. Do any of them still live with you or nearby?
My middle daughter's at home. I don't think it's forever. But my oldest is out, and my son is 18. He's out. He still manages to enrage me when we connect, but he's not here anymore. 18, an 18-year-old boy, truly, is just a blight on the earth. You know, it's a penis with no plan whatsoever. That's what it is. It's just difficult. Their frontal lobes are not developed. Frontal lobe, which is the part of the brain that does the planning, the understanding consequences, judgment, self-control, reasoning, all that, all those sort of executive functions are in the frontal lobe. And boys' frontal lobes don't develop till between 25 and 30. And let me tell you, when he lived here, I would check on him at night, and there was a divot there. So I don't think it's even begun to develop.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking with Paula Poundstone, who's going to be appearing at the Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo this coming Saturday night at 8 o'clock. Paula, you have a new book coming out in May. It's The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Tell me about some of the experiments that you did to find out what brings happiness.
Well, every chapter is written as an experiment, and I did a number of things. Some of them were short, some of them were long. The shortest one probably was just, I was going to spend a day with my pets, but instead, really, I didn't have time to spend all day. I spent several hours petting cats and brushing them and the like. You know, it's supposed to be good for your heart. I can't say that it was, but let's see. I went backpacking with my older daughter. I rented a Lamborghini. I spent a number of months taking Taekwondo and self-defense in order to get fit. The premise for me of the book from the very start wasn't just doing things and seeing if it in the moment made me happy. You know, for example, say I took, I did not in the book, but say I took a Ferris wheel ride, right? I like Ferris wheels, so I can guarantee you I would enjoy that. But unless my son was with me, he'd find a way to make it not fun. But the real question is, you know, I think happiness and fun are two different things. Mm-hmm. You know, the real question is, when I return to my regular life, have I stored up sort of an aquifer of happiness and contentment that can deflect the slings and arrows of my regular life? And so I would report back on how things were going, raising my children, taking care of my pets, just being stuck being me, doing my job. You know, hopefully they're the funniest field notes ever written. They are. It's kind of the anti-Facebook, really. You know, they say that reading, that looking at Facebook depresses people because it is a daily drip of a holiday letter. People post, you know, their happiest, most joyful moments. And even though we intellectually know that that's what's on there, you know, when you look at it, you can't help thinking, my life sucks. Whereas my book tells the down and dirty story of regular life. It covers about 7 years, actually.
So did driving a Lamborghini make you happy in the moment?
Well, even that, there were peaks and valleys. When I first got it, I was horrified, actually, because there were so many things on the panel, so much that you had to do. You know, it really didn't dawn on me until I was about to drive it off the lot that I had this kajillion-dollar machine, and that if I did anything to it accidentally, I was really in big trouble. And so the burden of the expense of the whole thing was heavy upon me the whole time. But having said that, I only had it for 24 hours, and I picked it up in the evening, and I drove home. I had gone to an acting class, and I drove home that night down Wilshire Boulevard, which even in my dented, you know, snack-filled van, it's kind of fun late at night when there's no traffic. Coming through the sort of Beverly Hills Westwood part is kind of fun. But in the Lamborghini, it was great. And then when I got home, I picked up my son, and we drove around, it was, I don't know, 11 or 12 at night, and we drove around, again, a very untrafficky Santa Monica, and it was really cool. Back in real life, the following day, you realize, well, in a town like Los Angeles, you're driving one of the fastest cars in the world in a town where you can't get more than a half a block's distance without having to stop. So some of the joy of it went away under real-life circumstances.
So right now I'm reading The Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And they say that nothing beautiful comes without some suffering. So it sounds like you may have come to a similar conclusion in your experiments.
Yeah, I never really thought of them as a rival before, but I do now. Yes, I think that's true. I do think that's true. I think that real happiness takes a lot of work. And sadly, in a really unromantic, fun way, it actually is a lot of biochemistry. You know, stuff like working out and how you eat and sleep and drink probably has a lot to do with it. I mean, I wish I could say it was something more exciting than that, but I don't even know that reading my book will provide lifelong happiness, but I have been told by the handful of people that have had the opportunity to read it so far. Dick Van Dyke, his wife, wrote to me that he kept quoting my book. So that gave me happiness. I feel like I can just stop right there. I once I got Carl Reiner, I was like, you know what? No matter what diagnoses I get, you know, the next time I go to the doctor, I'm good.
So speaking of books, you are a big supporter of libraries, and in fact, you're the national spokesperson for United for Libraries. Can you tell me about what that group is all about and what you do?
Well, you know, they're a fundraising arm of the library, and it's different in different cities. I used to think that all the library money came from the government, you know, which is also us, by the way. I hate it when people pretend that government money is anything other than our money. But in fact, it doesn't. It's not all part of our government budget. Each community has their own, they used to call it Friends of the Library. They've gone through about five names in the period of time that I've worked for them. But now it's United for Libraries, and they fundraise to provide things for their libraries to provide to the community. And there's a wide range of things. Obviously, books, periodicals, CDs, DVDs, things of that nature. But depending on the library, for example, in Santa Monica, there's teenage reading groups, there's homework clubs, there are adult reading groups, there's programs to encourage kids in their reading over the summer. And probably my favorite thing ever was we sat at a table at one point looking at some books, and I realized that there was a woman at the table just across the way teaching another woman to read. And when we left, I mean, we tried not to stare, but when we left, man, my hair was standing on end. And I said to my daughter, I said, you know, so often when you give to a charity, and it may be a very worthy charity, but you're never quite sure what percentage of your money makes it to the place where it's supposed to go, and whether this charity is really, you know, really making some inroads on whatever they're trying to fix or solve. I said, you know, the person volunteering to teach someone else to read can know for certain that their work, it's the ripple effect. It'll go on for generations. And that required the courage of the person who wanted to learn how to read to, you know, admit that they couldn't and seek help, and the volunteerism of the person that contributed. It was pretty impressive.
And that seems like something that will bring happiness in the moment and also some lasting joy, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're on this tour.
Well, I'm constantly on tour. It's not a tour like on the back of a sweatshirt. Mostly weekends and then, you know, home to sift litter boxes and then back out again.
What do you enjoy most about being on tour?
Well, hands down, my favorite part is just plain talking to the audience. I'm very lucky. I do a job, talk about happiness. I mean, I do a job that provides endorphins. I consider myself a proud member of the endorphin production industry, and I get to do it night after night to be with a group of people who have come out to laugh for the night, and it is fun. And I've gone on stage in every condition, exhausted, sick, whatever, sometimes just fine, by the way, but no matter what the circumstance, within a few seconds of hitting the stage, it's healing and fun, and it actually does build up. It lasts for a little while. That's the good part. The travel part, not so much. I wish I was Mrs. Weasley and could disapparate, but, you know, you learn to live with it after a while. You know, as the Dalai Lama says, you have to suffer for your happiness.
Well, I don't think we'll be suffering at all when we get to see you on the stage of the Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo this Saturday. I've been speaking with comedian Paula Poundstone, who will be appearing at the Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo on Saturday, presented by Otter Productions and Cal Poly Arts. We look forward to meeting with you and seeing you on Saturday, Paula.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.